Today is Monday, March 8th, International Women's Day, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Explosions detonate at a military base in Bata, Equatorial Guinea.
The explosion was the result of a fire in a weapon depot and negligence related to the use of dynamite at the base.
Plus, a member of Myanmar's ousted ruling party dies while in police custody.
The cause of King Monglat's death was not known, but Reuters saw a photograph of his body with a blood-stained cloth around the head.
And Pope Francis concludes his visit to Iraq. We'll have these stories and more next. The Minister of Public Health says multiple explosions at the Nkontoma military camp killed at least 20 and injured more than 500 others in Bata, Equatorial Guinea. Kaum Joel Hanore has this update.
President Teodoro Obiangema said the explosion that spread over the Nkontoma military camp detonated around 4 p.m. local time. The president's statement said the explosion was the result of a fire in a weapon depot and negligence related to the use of dynamite at the base. Health officials suspect there are still people missing inside the building damaged by the explosion. Hospitals are overcrowded, and Equatorial Guinea's foreign minister requested aid from neighboring countries. Kwame Joel Honore for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
A party official in Myanmar tells VOA's Burmese service a member from the ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party has died while in police custody. Reuters reporter Adam Reed has more.
The cause of King Monglat's death was not known, but Reuters saw a photograph of his body with a blood-stained cloth around the head. Police in the region declined to comment. It comes as security forces crack down on demonstrators, staging further widespread protests against last month's coup. Local media and video posted to Facebook said police fired stun grenades and tear gas to break up protesters in Yangon, and a sit-in protest by tens of thousands of people in Mandalay, where at least 70 people were arrested. Footage filmed by the Mayakina News Journal on February 28th showed a nun, which local media identified as Sister Anne Rosa, begging police not to fire. She was later photographed on her knees, stopping the police from advancing. The United Nations says security forces have killed more than 50 people in trying to stamp out daily demonstrations and strikes in the Southeast Asian nation since the military overthrew and detained Suu Kyi at the beginning of February. Figures from the Assistance Association for Political Prisoner Advocacy Group say well over 1,700 people have been detained under the military junta. An alliance of influential workers' unions in Myanmar has now called for an extended nationwide strike starting Monday, with the intention of causing the, quote, full extended shutdown of the country's economy in an attempt to end the military coup.
Adam Reed reports for Reuters News. Pope Francis celebrated Mass on his final full day of his much-anticipated visit to Iraq to offer solidarity with the country's Christians and other religious groups. His trip came amid ongoing turmoil among rival militias battling the central government and firing on demonstrators in the streets. Edward Uranian takes it from here.
Choir chanted to a crowd of thousands of Iraqis gathered to hear Pope Francis deliver Mass at a sports stadium in Erbil despite a minor rainstorm. Kurdish and Iraqi leaders, along with some foreign dignitaries, also attended. Francis urged everyone to help those who are suffering and in need. Francis says that we must get our hands dirty, acting responsibly, and not standing idly by, watching as our brothers and sisters suffer. He added, it is clear that the church is alive and that Christ is here among his holy people, going on to say, this is one of the reasons why I felt compelled to visit you and thank you. Francis said, Iraq will always remain in my heart, and I ask all of you to work together for a future of peace and prosperity that excludes and discriminates against no one. He also said, here in Iraq, so many of your brothers, sisters, friends, and fellow citizens bear the wounds of war and violence, and only God can heal these wounds.
Viva Papa! Viva Papa!
Earlier Sunday, during a visit to the Christian town of Karakosh outside the northern city of Mosul, the Pope blessed several young people who were in wheelchairs amid chants from the crowd of "Long live the Pope." In Mosul, the Pope addressed a crowd in front of a badly damaged church, urging Iraqi Christians to return to the city and help rebuild it. Thousands of Iraqi Christians left the country after the Islamic State group gained control of vast swaths of northern Iraq in 2014. A top church leader, Iraqi Chaldean Bishop Basil Yaldo, thanked Francis for his willingness to visit the country despite the ongoing turmoil there and global issues.
"We thank you for your courage that you would come here to our troubled land, a land so filled with violence, this place of endless disputes, displacement, and suffering among the people, and that you would do this in this time of global pandemic and crisis."
Khatar Abu Diab, who teaches political science at the University of Paris, tells VOA that the papal visit is largely symbolic, given the precarious state of Iraq, the Pope's health issues, and the COVID-19 pandemic.
"Cette visite, elle est symbolique en tant que telle.
He says that the visit is symbolic for Iraqi Christians as well as Christians from other parts of the Levant, but it is mostly to encourage those who have remained behind because it is doubtful that others who have emigrated to the West will return. Choir sang Chaldean religious songs to thank the Pope for his visit. Throngs also lined the road as his motorcade traveled through Erbil to return to Baghdad. Francis is due to fly back to the Vatican Monday morning. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Swiss citizens have narrowly approved a proposal that would prohibit women from wearing full facial coverings in public. Reporter Lisa Schlein says it's a controversial issue that has divided the country during an exceptionally heated campaign.
Campaigners, politicians, and the media have dubbed it the burqa ban, even though the burqa is not worn in Switzerland. The burqa, a full-body covering with a mesh screen to see through that is worn in Afghanistan, has come to symbolize the oppression of women. This is one of the messages figuring in a heated campaign leading up to Sunday's vote. Campaign posters of a menacing-looking woman wearing a black niqab with only her eyes exposed, reading "Stop Radical Islam" and "Stop Extremism" are plastered all over Switzerland. Critics of the proposed ban call it deeply racist and sexist. They say it is an attack against the Muslim community and is aimed at stigmatizing and marginalizing this minority group even more. The right-wing Swiss People's Party, which supports the ban, disagrees. It claims the burqa initiative defends the dignity of women. However, Swiss parliamentarian Jean-Luc Adore acknowledges the campaign is calling for an end to what supporters see as the Islamization of Switzerland.
"This is something that we find shocking. It is fundamentally in opposition with various values of our civilization, simply because, for us, free people show their faces in all circumstances outside."
The irony of demanding a ban on full face coverings has not escaped many at a time when Switzerland's 8.5 million people are obliged to wear masks to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. The Swiss federal government opposes the proposal. Justice Minister Evelyn Widmer-Schlumpf says accepting the initiative would unnecessarily endanger religious peace in the country.
"Acceptation de l'initiative mettrait inutilement en péril la paix religieuse dans notre pays."
She says it would violate human rights, which are guaranteed under international conventions. Furthermore, she says passage of the initiative would tarnish Switzerland's reputation as a country that values the protection of fundamental rights. Debates about various symbols of Islam, including burqas and niqabs, have been going on for years. In 2009, Swiss voters approved another Swiss People's Party initiative to ban the building of minarets in the country. Many people in Switzerland believe the proposed ban on full face coverings is much ado about nothing. They note only some 30 women in Switzerland wear the niqab. About half are Swiss converts to Islam, and the other half are tourists who come to this alpine country for vacation. The latest opinion poll suggests the referendum will pass by a slim margin. If it does, Switzerland will join five other European countries that have full or partial bans of face covering in place. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Jury selection begins Monday in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the white police officer accused of second-degree murder and the death of African-American George Floyd. Video of the incident in Minneapolis last May sparked protests around the world. Michael Sullivan reports the trial follows the anniversary of another racial incident that shook Los Angeles 30 years ago.
The fired officer was seen in a video nearly 9 minutes long with his knee on George Floyd's neck. Floyd died in police custody. The officer, Derek Chauvin, is charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter. Three other former officers are charged as accomplices and are being tried separately. Minneapolis is quiet after months of protests and violence that broke out after Floyd's death in May. But the community is still tense, says a local religious leader.
Our city is bracing for seemingly, the inevitable, meaning some, disruption, perhaps some unrest and protests, as the trial gets underway.
Across the country in Los Angeles, revived memories of an incident 30 years ago, the police beating of a black motorist, Rodney King. After the failure to convict four officers charged with excessive use of force, the city erupted in violence that left more than 60 dead and caused $1 billion in property damage. It has been called part of a pattern.
I was there in L.A. when it was a Rodney King beating, and I watched that and I said, man, if they get away with this now, what's going to happen later? And it continues to happen.
George Floyd's killing sparked protests throughout the United States and around the world, from Britain to Senegal.
A lot has changed. Still, a lot has not changed. And the number one thing that has not changed enough is accountability. We had zero accountability with the Rodney King beating.
And too little now, she says. Amid the outrage and grief after Floyd's death, she says too many police killings that she thinks are unjustified have gone unpunished. Both observers agree these are historic times.
We'll reflect back and we'll ask them, where were we in that moment? What happened? And we'll all remember where we were, right? We'll all know that. But the question is, what did we do?
Police point out the dangers of their work and say community-based policing and other alternative approaches, which are now being explored in many cities, can engage law enforcement and local residents as partners. Police killings in the United States remain at around 1,000 to 1,100 a year, according to ongoing tallies by the Washington Post and an online site called Mapping Police Violence. Most stem from violent confrontations between suspects and police, and some suspects like Floyd are unarmed. Half of those killed are white, yet those studies show that African Americans are disproportionately affected. Activists say the mounting toll shows the need for a radically different kind of policing in American cities. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
If you have questions or comments about any of the stories in today's program, connect with me on Twitter. I'm at It's Steve Miller. And coming up later,
one of the hardest things in the process of trying to find the girls is that ISIS switches locations of the girls all the time.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Last August, scientists said they had an answer to what caused the noticeable drop in the brightness of the star Betelgeuse earlier in the year. After observing the red giant star with the Hubble Space Telescope, the scientists said the dimming was probably due to it ejecting vast amounts of material into space, which formed a dust cloud that blocked light from coming from its surface. Scientists are now looking at the dimming of VY Canis Majoris, a star in the constellation Canis Major. After observing this much bigger, more massive and violent red hypergiant star with the Hubble, scientists say that the same mechanisms that caused Betelgeuse to dim is also causing VY Canis Majoris to lose its brightness. While Betelgeuse regained its normal brightness in a matter of weeks, the scientists say the dim periods with VY Canis Majoris could last years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Auckland, New Zealand's biggest city, emerged on Sunday from a strict week-long lockdown imposed after a community cluster emerged, the more contagious coronavirus variant that was first discovered in Britain. Reuters' Brian Wood has the details.
Health officials said the country recorded zero cases for a full week. People were able to leave their homes Sunday morning and fetch a coffee. Many felt relieved.
It's lovely to be out and about again. It's hard being confined for long periods of time. We've done it before, but it's refreshing to be out and about.
The city of 2 million people will continue to face restrictions, like crowd gathering limits and masks on public transportation, but those may be eased at the end of this week. Its neighboring Australia has also been successful in keeping infections down, with zero cases reported in more than a month. New Zealand and Australia have deployed aggressive tactics like contact tracing, border closures, and foreign traveler quarantines. Their economies have made fast improvements, while both countries have started rolling out vaccines. Australia administered its first dose of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine on Sunday, now an option alongside the vaccine from Pfizer BioNTech.
Brian Wood reports for Reuters News. The Dalai Lama, Tibet's spiritual leader, urged the world to be brave and get vaccinated Saturday after he was inoculated with the coronavirus vaccine in the northern Indian town of Dharamshala. However, some countries are having trouble obtaining enough vaccines for their populations. An Associated Press report says the European Union is set to appeal to Washington to make sure that EU countries receive the millions of AstraZeneca vaccine doses they still need, as well as ingredients needed to produce vaccines. For over a century, International Women's Day, which is taking place today on March 8th, has celebrated women's achievements across the globe. It's a time set aside to honor women, both in their roles as breadwinners and as mothers who nurture their children and care for their health. However, when it comes to breastfeeding their babies for the first 6 months of their life, which Alive and Thrive and other NGOs say contributes to kids' health and well-being, women must often have to choose between their jobs and breastfeeding their babies. In Nigeria, that has been changing. A national law already mandates 4 months of paid maternity leave for women in the public sector, and four of the country's 36 states have increased that benefit to 6 months. Meanwhile, worksite lactation rooms and daycare are becoming more commonplace. In Nigeria's parliament is debating a proposal to make 6 months paid maternity leave a national right for women in both the private and public sectors. Now, to find out more about this issue, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Modupe Oyekule, the national coordinator of the Association of Nigerian Women Business Network, which has been steadily advocating for the issue.
This is the question I asked as well when the project was introduced to us by NECA, working with Alive and Thrive. When we started the project, I thought it was going to be easy to just get organized private sector to take this on and set up a creche or a lactation center within the organization such that a woman that is very, very talented, skilled, competent within a team will not be lost as a result of being in the child-rearing period of our life.
So what happened?
We had a lot of organized private sectors that were four. But, you know, we had a lot also that were against. I said, no, we don't need it. It's going to be a distraction for the women. And they lost directors, managers, because immediately after their 3 months maternity leave, they had no choice but to stay back with their children.
It couldn't be good for their businesses to have those women leave.
Losing a competent and skilled staff contributes to the bottom line of any organization.
But what about women in the informal economy, in the shops and markets, in agriculture, and in more rural places generally?
Yeah, the informal sector. We have the market women, the women that they have stores, they have shops. Most of them have their children with them. I want to say that this will be something that Alive and Thrive should actually look at to see how within an organized market, there can be a crèche. I can come into my store, drop my child, go check my child because it's just within the mall or within the market.
So overall, how well would you say the activism for this national law is going?
So there's a lot of progress, but, you know, 4 states out of 36 states is still a far cry. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
The proposed national legislation is a lot more women-friendly than the U.S., for example, which has no national maternity leave mandate for either public or private sector employees. Are other West African nations following the Nigerian model?
I don't have validated research with respect to that, but I must say that Nigeria is actually always at the forefront of a lot of things.
Would you be content with a system where a mother would be given 3 months paid leave, then given lactation and childcare accommodations when back at work?
I'll go for both approaches, depending on the capacity of the organization. I'm for the 6 month maternity leave, but then there are some organizations that are not at that level. Once we can pass the bill at the national level for a 6 month, then every organization will not have a choice. After the 6 month, when you come back, you are supposed to breastfeed for another 6 months if you can, and then to be able to continue breastfeeding, promoting 2 years.
What kind of feedback have you gotten from the public sector women in the 4 states that now allow 6 months maternity leave?
Oh, it's made a superb influence to them. You will see a lot of civil servants excited about this. The negative feedback probably might be from the small businesses. Small businesses might not be able to cope at the moment, except you have a national framework that is legislated. At that point, everybody will have to go with it.
Any final word for our African listeners on this International Women's Day?
Let us continue to challenge the status quo. Promote participation within democracy that will ensure women's leadership and economic equality. Number two, women must develop themselves such that once such opportunities are available for them from the leadership and economy, they would be able to step up their game based on their competencies and their skills set. And thirdly, every organization, both public and private sector, should actually be seen from the perspective of inclusion and diversity.
Madupe Oyekule is the national coordinator of the Association of Nigerian Women Business Network, and she was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. And finally, two documentaries shine a light on women defying the odds in the face of brutality and corruption. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmakers and has this story.
It's the middle of the night, and a team of Yazidi volunteers sneak into the Al-Hol refugee camp in northeastern Syria to identify and free Yazidi girls and women known as sabayas, sexual captives hidden away by ISIS supporters. After the fall of the Islamic State, the camp became known for housing both supporters and victims of ISIS. Speaking through a translator, filmmaker Hogir Hirori says he came to the dangerous area to film his documentary Sabaya, armed with both a gun and a camera.
One of the hardest things in the process of trying to find the girls is that ISIS switches locations of the girls all the time.
Hirori, an ethnic Kurd who fled to Sweden, says finding these women would have been impossible had it not been for other women, among them former sabayas, who dared to sneak back into the camp to help those left behind. Sabaya shows freed girls with babies and toddlers in tow, fathered by their captors. Initially, many are fearful that their families would not welcome them back. But Hirori says with the help of the volunteers, many of these traumatized women slowly rebound and find a purpose saving others. In the documentary Writing with Fire, 32-year-old Mira is the chief reporter of Khabar Lariya, the only newspaper run by women in the Indian province of Uttar Pradesh. Filmmakers Arintu Thomas and Sushmit Ghosh of the acclaimed documentary Writing with Fire explain how these Dalit women defy India's rigid caste system.
I mean, mostly Dalit women for an upper caste man would essentially be women who would be cleaning their toilets. But when they're confronted with the sight of a woman with a mobile phone asking them questions, they don't know what to say. I think essentially they're stumped.
The film shows these women asking men in power positions hard questions about rape, corruption, and oppression of minorities. Some have only basic education, while others have studied journalism. Many are mothers and wives. Mira, for example, has managed the household since the age of 14. The filmmakers say, despite the patriarchal Indian system in Uttar Pradesh, these women enjoy the support of their husbands and fathers. They are breadwinners who work hard.
This is their everyday routine. You're taking a train for a couple of hours, and then you're taking a bus, and then you're taking a rickshaw, and then you're walking for about 2 to 3 hours to get to a village that doesn't exist on a map. That journey itself can break you down.
Armed with their mobile cameras, these women push through boundaries. Khabar Lariya, the digital news platform they created, boasts 150 million viewers so far and is growing. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iran is one of the countries that tragically uses detention of foreign nationals and dual citizens for political leverage. Along with other foreign nationals, several U.S. citizens are currently held unjustly or wrongfully in Iran. One of them is a former UNICEF official, Bakir Namazi. The Iranian government released the ailing 84-year-old Iranian-American from prison last year because of his serious medical problems, but has barred him from leaving the country. Bakir Namazi was arrested 5 years ago after he flew to Iran to visit his son Siamak, a businessman who had been unjustifiably arrested and imprisoned in Iran in 2015. Both father and son were falsely charged with cooperating with an enemy power. On the anniversary of Bakir Namazi's arrest, Special Presidential Envoy for Hostage Affairs Roger Karstens tweeted, "Today is another sad day at Free the Namazis, as this American family continues to be separated. For 5 years, Iran has held U.S. citizen Bakir Namazi, while his son Siamak is wrongfully held in Evin prison. Hashtag Iran must allow them to be reunited and together in freedom." In a television interview, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan called the unjust detention of American citizens in Iran a complete and utter outrage. He said the Biden-Harris administration has begun to communicate with the Iranians on this issue and is sending a strong message. "We will not accept a long-term proposition where they continue to hold Americans in an unjust and lawful manner," said National Security Advisor Sullivan. "It will be a significant priority of this administration to get those Americans safely back home." Iran is not the only country to unjustly detain foreign nationals for political political advantage, and Americans are not the only victims. Recently, some 58 countries, including the United States, endorsed a Canadian-led declaration denouncing arbitrary detention in state-to-state relations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted that the practice of arbitrary detention is already prohibited under international human rights conventions. But some countries still do it, and we as a global community have to stand against it, he said. It's time to send a clear message to every government that arbitrarily detains foreign nationals and tries to use them as leverage. This will not be tolerated by the international community.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.